and them really sharing their perspective with me and saying, like, pass this on, take this to your people, take this to your community, and share what we feel.
Hallo und willkommen. Hamburg Arts, das ist ein Podcast mit Themen und Geschichten aus der Kunstwelt. Und ich bin Kai Detlefs, Journalist in Hamburg. Heute rede ich mit Nicola Brand über ihre Kindheit und Jugend in Namibia während der Apartheid. Meine Frage ist, inwieweit hat diese Zeit sie in ihrem Werk, in ihrem als Künstlerin und in ihrer Sichtweise beeinflusst und geprägt? Apartheid heißt, das ist die sogenannte Rassentrennung. Das sind krasse soziale Gegensätze. Eine schwarze Mehrheit sieht sich einer herrschenden weißen Minderheit gegenüber, darunter viele Farmer und Großgrundbesitzer mit deutschen Vorfahren. Das Ganze eine Folge und das Erbe der Kolonialzeit. So, und jetzt zur Fotografie, zu ihrem Buch mit diesen ungewöhnlichen Landschaften, diesen weiten Landschaften der Wüste in Namibia. Das sind Bilder, Fotografie mit einer, wie ich finde, ganz besonderen psychologischen Tiefe. Und dann eben die Herero-Frauen, die in ihren Gewändern, Herero-Frauen in ihren auffallend farbenfrohen Gewändern aufwendig gearbeitet und offenbar europäisch beeinflusst. Auch dazu habe ich Fragen. So, und jetzt begrüße ich Nicola Brand. Nicola, you told me you were growing up during the apartheid, right?
Absolutely. So I was born in 1983. I like to think I'm young, but I'm not that young anymore. Namibia was part of, was regarded as a protectorate of South Africa for several decades. So for some South Africans, they saw Namibia as the kind of the fifth province. After several decades of a liberation war or civil war, where many Namibians, especially the Awambo community tribe, they fought for independence. Namibia gained its democratic identity only in 1990. I believe it's one of the last, if not the last, second to South Africa, country in Africa to actually have gained independence from quote-unquote colonial apartheid rule. So yes, I was for about 7 years or 7 to 8 years a child under the apartheid regime, and they were very contentious years. They were very volatile years. And certainly as a child, I sensed those ruptures, even if they were not always on my doorstep. It was in the air, it was in the news. My parents were discussing it around the table at lunch and dinner. So yes, those years certainly left an imprint on my identity, and perhaps also why I later would choose to make this the focus of my work as an artist and as a researcher.
So how was everyday life during the apartheid time for you, being a teenager?
I think it's a very good question. You know, when you're born into something, it's normalized and you know no different. So it's only when you get some distance, and you know, I traveled extensively. I've lived outside of Namibia for several years as an adult. So, you know, I came to understand my Namibianess and my childhood through a different lens, having that critical distance. But, I think what became apparent is maybe the question of intergenerational privilege, but also intergenerational trauma. So, being raised in a largely white community, however, being in a country where the majority, we're talking, I think, probably up to 90% of Namibians are persons of color, are from different ethnic groups, Iwambo, Herero, Nama, Damra, Sam. But, you know, I belong to kind of a minority group, but obviously, you know, white Namibians were privileged, highly privileged minority group. So, you know, those discrepancies were probably quite vivid. I mean, just through schooling options, through, in a sense, being protected from the brutality of the kind of the liberation struggle right at, in those last years towards the end of apartheid. There was also a lot of tension, I have to say, because my parents ended up sending me to a multiracial school, which, you know, I think for many decades under apartheid, the schooling systems were quite divided. So, you know, white children would go to white schools and black children would go to black schools. And I ended up going to two schools that were multiracial. But you felt, even if the children, you know, they were young and I was, you know, obviously among them, there's definitely tension because their parents had held a lot of anger and resentment as to the status quo of living in a very divided, a divided country and a divided city. I mean, you know, the physical imprint of apartheid is literally visible on the land. Now, you know, it's more than 25 years since the kind of the end of apartheid in Namibia. You know, things have changed considerably, but there's still a physical imprint on the land. And I think my work really does grapple with that, and not only on the land, but also in the psyches of the people.
So in a way, you are, in my view, an advocate dealing with all these historical issues in Namibia and these racial issues in your book. And now, what do people of color think about your work? How do they approach you, and what do they think about your work and your viewpoint?
That's a very big question. I certainly couldn't speak for such a broad group of people. I've had, for the most part, very positive responses. I think because this journey of going deeper into this field of art, and, you know, to some extent, I call it memory activism, has taken several years, and I think I've tried to be as sensitive and nuanced as possible. Generally, I think there's an appreciation. I mean, there's a feeling that there's a Namibian of European ancestry, of German ancestry, who is, you know, in a sense, really engaging and trying to think critically and looking in a self-reflexive way back onto her own inheritance, and in a sense also trying to own it as much as one can own something which is not necessarily part of my immediate life. I mean, my inheritance arguably goes all the way back to when my great-grandfather arrived in 1910. So I think on the whole, it's been very generative. There have been, you know, difficult conversations, and I've certainly cut my teeth or earned my stripes with mom's feeling, you know, that I'm in a sense a lightning rod for a lot of frustration, where perhaps, let's say, artists from different communities, from say Herero or Ewambu, feel that they can't always access a more closed or sheltered, say, white Namibian, the white Namibian individuals or groups, where there's still a sense of maybe people are living, you know, in their own kind of echo chambers or bubbles. So, you know, I have felt in moments that I've been, in a sense, a conduit for frustrations or them really sharing their perspective with me and saying, like, pass this on, take this to your people, take this to your community and share what we feel. So, yeah, those have been interesting and also in moments tense, but I've felt that there's always been an openness and a capacity for dialogue, and I've learned a lot as I've gone through the process over the last, make it almost, it's been perhaps 15, almost 20 years that I've been exploring and working in this field.
How about the living conditions today? How do people of color live today in Namibia, and how far are they still underprivileged?
I think, you know, the living conditions vary greatly. I mean, as I mentioned, Namibia is considered, I think, along with South Africa, one of the most unequal countries in the world. So, you know, you have dire poverty, unemployment, people living hand to mouth. But then you also have, with the end of apartheid, you know, the government is primarily, you know, they're primarily persons of color, Black Namibians, Awambos, with, you know, a smattering of other tribes or ethnic groups. So, you know, there's a very strong Black elite, and they live incredibly, you know, again, privileged lives. I think in terms of power, there's a small, you know, group, you know, of you know, the Black elite, but there's also, you know, in terms of business and economics, there's also a lot of power still in the hands of white Namibians, also pertaining to the actual ownership of land. So the statistic might be slightly more or less, but I believe something like 6 or 7% of the population, which is white, South African, Afrikaans, and German, own, you know, over 60-70% of the commercial farmland still today in Namibia. So, and that gives you a bit of perspective on the commercial and business front of, you know, how this minority group still has quite a degree of economic power. But yeah, there's certainly all different. There's a host of various realities in Namibia, but sadly, the country still remains, you know, a vast majority of the population still remain quite disenfranchised.
In your book, I enjoy to see all these tremendous and unbelievable landscapes in Namibia. And of course, I could see these Black women wearing these colorful dresses. And now my question is, how about these colorful dresses? I mean, what is the story about these very special dresses of Black women?
The Herero dress is a fascinating, I would call it almost like a living monument. The dress came about with the arrival of the German and Rhenish missionary settlers in the mid-19th century that actually, you know, the first, arguably, the first colonialists that came to Namibia, and their exchange with other Herero, so the Herero people. The Herero actually appropriated these, you know, they almost look like Victorian dresses, and over the coming decades would adapt the dress and, in a sense, make it very much a part of their own identity, their own cultural identity. So it's this idea of hybridity in culture. You know, cultures are never static or singular. It's often the meeting of different groups that come together and create a kind of a new cultural expression. But in this case, the Herero dress is very specific to that culture. So traditionally, they're about, I think, between 6 and 8, if I'm not mistaken, petticoats, undergarments, and then on top of it, there's the actual dress made in very beautiful, often very colorful fabric. In the last few years or decades, the headdress, which is called the Ochikaiva, has emulated the cow horns, because the cow is a very big part of Herero culture. They were originally pastoralists, and many of them still have cattle, which is a big part of their identity and also their income. So the cow is it's almost like a sacred animal. So actually the women do have these incredible headdresses, which in a sense mirror the structure of the cow horns. It's a dress that's quite complex, because on the one hand, it speaks about this contact moment or contact period with colonizers who came and, in many senses, not only pushed Herero and Nama and others off the land, but also in the end, as you know, there was the terrible war and genocide of 1904 to 1908. For some people, it feels kind of contradictory. Why would you appropriate the dress of a colonizer? But when I've spoken to several Herero, you know, they give different answers for it. Some say it's a form of empowerment. Some say that actually going all the way back, It's almost like a warrior attitude. So when you killed, you know, a German settler in the war, you would almost appropriate their uniform as a kind of transferring their power to you. But there's no singular answer as to this fascinating meeting of cultures, but also obviously quite controversial, but obviously quite a painful history as well. So the dress is certainly a living monument to this long and complex history.
You're saying it's a living monument. So in one respect, it's not for daily use, okay?
That's a good question. In fact, Kukuekue Mambari, the woman that I a colleague, and she became a friend, we traveled quite extensively, especially along the coast of Namibia, and she features in my book, The Distance Within. She would actually wear the dress on a daily basis, but she's from an older generation of Herero women. But other Herero, you know, it's definitely a dress that you wear on also formal occasions like weddings and funerals, and it's a ceremonial dress. But there are some that do wear it more regularly. The men, however, their military garb they wear very much on the days that commemorate the war and genocide. For example, it's called the Red Flag Day in Okahania, where the men actually dress up in military uniforms to some extent that emulated the Schutztruppe outfits, but also in the meantime they've been adapted and changed. I mean, I believe they're also buying some of these military uniforms from Korea and from China, and so it's this idea of a uniform that expresses power and unity.
Well, this is it. Nicola, thanks for your time. Noch ein Hinweis in eigener Sache. Ich freue mich natürlich über Bewertungen, seien es Sterne bei Apple Podcasts oder Spotify oder einer kleinen schriftlichen Bewertung. Und diese Bewertungen sind einfach wichtig für das Wachstum so eines Kanals und das gerade bei diesem zentral wichtigen Thema. Dafür vorab schon mal danke. Und ich bin Kai Detlefs, Journalist in Hamburg, und ich freue mich, wenn wir uns hier wieder demnächst begegnen. Tschüss und auf bald!